A car bomb attack targeting an Afghan lawmaker. And the capital, Kabul, leaves at least 9 people dead and 20 others injured. Britain imposes a strict Christmas lockdown in southeastern England, warning that a new strain of the coronavirus is out of control. Talks between Britain and the European Union on a post-Brexit trade deal remain deadlocked over European fishermen's access to UK waters. I'm Marcia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story this hour takes us to Afghanistan, where at least 9 people, including women and children, have been killed in a blast in the capital, Kabul. Authorities say some 20 others were also injured in the explosion in the western part of Kabul. It caused damage to homes and several vehicles. A member of the Afghan parliament was the target of the assault. He survived the attack but sustained injuries. Afghanistan has recently witnessed a wave of deadly attacks despite an ongoing peace talk between the Taliban militant group and the government. On Friday, an explosion hit a religious gathering in Ghazni province, leaving at least 15 children dead and 20 others injured. There was no claim of responsibility, but a provincial police spokesman described the Ghazni blasts as a Taliban act, an attack. Political commentator Tim Anderson believes peace will not return to Afghanistan unless Western countries fully withdraw their forces from there.
There has to be an independent country to deal with its own problems. It's simply not possible under a foreign occupation army for normality to come about. It's never happened anywhere. It's not going to happen here, basically. The US has to be forced to retreat at some stage. And then the structures of society have to be rebuilt, indigenous structures of society. Now, the U.S. has aggravated the problems of Afghanistan in the last 2 decades, and it's only after the U.S. leaves that there's any possibility of restoring some sort of stability, some sort of normality. They can't tell their home constituency that they're making progress when there is none to be made and when there are bodies coming home from those sorts of countries. So they are rather cynical. They would like other people to carry out the violence for them, other people to go home in body bags, but they certainly have no good intentions in terms of leaving behind a stable and peaceful Afghanistan.
Well, since the Saudi coalition began its war on Yemen, it has had undeclared goals, including the obliteration of Yemeni antiquities and everything related to Yemen's history that goes back thousands of years. During a press conference in Sanaa, the General Authority of Antiquities and Museums revealed the extent of the damage inflicted in that country.
The destruction caused by the Saudi coalition in Yemen was not limited to infrastructure and residential areas. Rather, archaeological and terrorist sites were also targeted by airstrikes aimed at destroying the Yemeni civilization that extends for thousands of years.
The material damage is very extensive, and the strikes have affected castles, forts, and historical monuments that carry a human dimension which goes beyond the limits of time and space. The systematic targeting of ancient monuments exposes the conspiracies of the Saudi coalition, which seeks to form a new identity that suits its colonial ambitions.
Tilla City in Shibam Kaukaban is one of the historical cities that has been repeatedly pounded by airstrikes. A large number of antiquities there have been destroyed as a result. To shed light on this, the General Authority for Antiquities and Museums held a press conference, the first of its kind, in which it reviewed the extent of the damage to Yemeni antiquities during the Saudi-led war.
The importance of this conference is that 6 years have passed and our antiquities are being bombed and destroyed. So the world will realize that Yemen is a storehouse of antiquities that belong to mankind and not only Yemenis. Therefore, we demand the Saudi coalition not to bomb Yemen's antiquities and its archaeological sites.
In addition to the cultural devastation caused by Saudi Arabia during the 5 years of war, Yemen suffers from a tragic humanitarian situation that the United Nations has described as the world's worst human-made humanitarian crisis. hidden Saudi hatred has been exposed by the incessant and systematic targeting of everything related to the history of Yemen in an attempt to obliterate a civilization that extends for millennia. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The British Health Minister warns that a new strand of the coronavirus in the UK is out of control.
The new variant is out of control, and we need to bring it under control. And this news about the new variant has been an incredibly difficult end to, frankly, an awful year. And it's important for everybody to act, essentially act like they might have the virus.
Hancock said the government has imposed a strict Christmas lockdown in London and southeast England to get the new strain under control. He said strict measures could stay in place until the virus vaccine is fully rolled out. On Saturday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said millions must cancel Christmas plans and stay home. He said that's because the new COVID-19 variant spreads far more quickly. Well, the warning has prompted European countries to ban flights from the UK. Saeed Pourreza in London says there's a lot of anger and frustration in the UK following the strict measures to battle the new strain of the coronavirus there.
That's the situation now. It has obviously impacted the plans of millions of people who have been looking forward to the holidays over the past months, listening to the government saying they were not going to cancel it all, they were not going to impose harsh repressive restrictions. But that's all down a drain now. It's not happening. Only in some areas that are still in tiers 3, 2, and 1 are people allowed to meet only on Christmas Day, and that rule of three households being able to mix will only happen on a single day, which will be that one Christmas Day, happening, for example, in Wales and Scotland. But before and after the day, strict measures are still in place. A lot of frustration and anger, especially this uncertainty about the future, how people's lives and livelihoods will be impacted by this virus, and now the new strain of it that is more deadly than the original COVID-19.
Europe keeps struggling with the second wave of COVID-19, with daily cases and deaths remaining high in several countries. New infections have topped 13,000 in the Netherlands during the past 24 hours. That's the highest daily number there since the pandemic began. The Dutch government has imposed tough restrictions, including nighttime curfews for the Christmas holidays. Germany has also begun a strict lockdown earlier this week to contain the spread of the disease. The country on Sunday posted over 22,000 new cases. And in Russia, new daily infections were almost 29,000. Last week, Europe became the first region in the world to pass 500,000 deaths from COVID-19. Meanwhile, the number of daily coronavirus infections in Iran has dropped to their lowest level in nearly 2 months. The health ministry registered just over 6,300 new cases in the past 24 hours. Sunday also marks the sixth straight day of a decline in the number of daily cases in Iran. The country on the same day posted 177 new deaths. The figure was slightly higher than Saturday, but continued a downward trend since early December. Iran has been under strict restrictions for a month now that helped contain the virus, but authorities have warned of a new resurgence if gatherings continue and health protocols are not observed. Overall, Iran has registered over 1.1 million COVID cases with 53,000 fatalities. Well, the U.S. is facing a host of issues related to the coronavirus pandemic, which are threatening the fabric of the society. People are waiting in lines for food, with many unemployed, and just last week, claims for jobless benefits increased unexpectedly. All these would make the job of the incoming President Joe Biden much harder.
The number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits continues to surge at unprecedented levels. Just last week, another 885,000 people filed for first-time unemployment. This is the highest level in the past 3 months. Since the start of the pandemic, more people have lost their jobs and incomes and have become dependent on assistance. Overall, about 20.65 million people are receiving unemployment benefits of some kind since the coronavirus pandemic started in the U.S. The loss of income made millions of American families food insecure. Throughout the pandemic, food banks and pantries have provided millions of Americans with much-needed food. Although hunger is not new in America, the pandemic has had a major impact. Food insecurity has become a widespread national issue, sparing not even some of the wealthier regions. A recent survey shows that 1 in 8 Americans reported that they sometimes, or often, did not have enough food. Overall, food insecurity has doubled since last year, reaching the highest level since 1998. Before the pandemic, the majority of the food bank's clients were the elderly and the underemployed. But there's been a recent influx of service workers who have been disproportionately hit by the COVID-19 crisis. Food insecurity rates spiked at the end of March, when pandemic lockdowns made the U.S. economy stumble. People from Alaska to Georgia are turning to food distribution centers to pick up free groceries. Activists say that food banks are under extra pressure ahead of the upcoming holidays, as requests have skyrocketed. They say that millions of Americans are barely making ends meet and need help to feed their families. Moreover, data by the U.S. Census Bureau indicate that more Americans are going hungry than at any point during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Experts say economic conditions are the main reason behind hunger in the United States. In 2019 and before the pandemic began, more than 35 million Americans struggled with hunger. Unless Congress soon agrees on a new coronavirus stimulus package, aid benefits will end for some 12 million workers at the end of this month. Now, President-elect Joe Biden will take office on January the 20th. One of the major challenges he's facing is the unemployment crisis. More than 19 million Americans are receiving unemployment benefits. Now, they include around 13 million who have lost their jobs during the pandemic.
The overall U.S. unemployment rate is currently 6.7%, which, while better than previous months, still means that 10 million pre-pandemic jobs have been lost. Economists have said that the jobs that have not returned by this point will be the hardest to claw back, because they're concentrated in the industries most affected by virus containment measures, like leisure, travel, and hospitality. This means that employment gains that people saw during Trump's presidency may not continue at the same pace under Biden. That is because prolonged unemployment, especially in a weak labor market, can be harder to fix. Analysts say that people who have been unemployed for 6 months or more are about twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as to find employment. Moreover, the longer a person is out of work, the less consumer purchasing they do, which further slows economic growth. Data shows that long-term unemployment as a share of unemployment is growing fast across America. In October, 3.6 million of the 11 million unemployed Americans had been out of work for 6 months or longer. That is a ratio not seen since mid-2014, when Biden was the country's vice president. The continuing unemployment crisis has led economists to become increasingly pessimistic about when the country might return to pre-pandemic levels. Business and academic economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal in April predicted the labor market would recover by the year 2022. But when surveyed again in October, 55% had extended their recovery forecast to the year 2023 or later. In the meantime, there are those who believe the mass vaccination can make real change, but it could be months until the jabs are widely distributed.
Until a certain proportion within the population is not immunized, the impact of the vaccine cannot be visible. For instance, we have to vaccinate at least 70 out of 100 people to achieve the herd immunity. At that point, we will start seeing the benefit of the vaccine in breaking the transmission. Although the U.S. has urged to have 100 million doses in the first quarter of 2021, but even if that is started, what we're looking is that August, September would be the time when we will have the herd immunity in the United States. At that point, we will start seeing positive impact on. But before that, It is unfortunate, very grim situation.
Well, talks between Britain and the European Union drag on into Sunday amid a disagreement over European fishermen's access to UK waters. A British government source said the EU is making demands that are not compatible with Britain's independence. The source added that a deal is not possible without a substantial shift from the bloc. But a European diplomat said Britain needs to accept the last EU offer on fishing rights unless it wants a no-deal Brexit. The two sides must get a deal by December the 31st. The European Parliament has demanded an agreement by midnight on Sunday to allow time for a review and ratification before the end of the year. A no-deal scenario would mean border chaos for both sides and reliance on World Trade Organization rules that could possibly lead to price hikes. Well, China says it has tailed a U.S. warship in the Strait of Taiwan. Now, that comes a week after Washington approved a new arms sale to the island. Despite opposition from Beijing, the U.S.'s support for Taiwan has been one of the sources of contention between Washington and Beijing.
The Chinese military on Saturday said it had tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The military said the move deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. It said the move jeopardizes peace and stability in the strait. The Chinese military also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it called selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy, however, said its guided missile destroyer wasn't a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its own territory and is opposed to the increasing U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. Washington says the sale aims to improve the security of Taiwan, but some analysts believe the U.S. seeks to push back against China.
The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope, is trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and China over other issues as well, from trade to the coronavirus pandemic and political developments in Hong Kong. The U.S. has also prepared a so-called entity list that mainly hits key Chinese industries over what Washington calls ties to China's military. On Thursday, the Pentagon said U.S. warships would be more assertive in responding to what it described as violations of international law. It accused China of being the most pressing long-term strategic threat. In response, China said it seeks no conflict with the U.S. and wants mutual respect and cooperation leading to a win-win outcome.
We hope that the U.S. side will take a rational and objective view of China's development of its national defense and armed forces, work with China to focus on cooperation, manage differences, and bring the China-U.S. relationship back to the right track.
The souring ties between China and the U.S. come in the wake of President Donald Trump's America First policy. With the incoming U.S. President Joe Biden set to take office on January 20th, it remains to be seen how the currently toxic relationship between the world's two biggest economies will look like. Will the new U.S. president stick to Trump's policy tools and continue the frictions? Will he try to de-escalate the tensions, or will he take a more aggressive anti-China approach?
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back. We met Javad Karayi, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled, it is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten. But the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Berries is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Shir Muhammad Rahul. To get to Sham-e-Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Shir Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khore Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khor or firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khore Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal, saline, or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season, and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Gwadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilak. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hotags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Shir Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bash is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people. traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shahbakhsh. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment, a place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I, too, am proud of these honest, kind people, proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
إني أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're gonna be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum wa al'an alahum ajma'in.
As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, we were talking about the state of intimacy, hub, and love, and also longing for the Almighty Allah in our supplications. We have mentioned up to now different traditions and narrations, and the supplications and whispered prayers that were transmitted to us from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And you have found out by now that these are rich in such lively and dynamic illustrations, and they are describing the state of intimacy and yearning truly. This is true in particular about the 15 whispered prayers that Allama Majlisi has narrated in Biharul Anwar from Imam Zainul Abidin, Ali ibn al-Husayn, which are replete with such concepts as intimacy and yearning that we tried to cover in the previous programs. We find in the heritage of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam a treasure of such illustrations and concepts that we seldom find in the heritage of the others. رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ. Now, I assume our discussion is over, but before we conclude our discussion, let me mention some of these unique illustrations. O Allah, who can have tasted the sweetness of your love that wanted another in place of you? Who can have become intimate with your nearness, then sought removal from you? O Allah, places with him whom you have chosen for your nearness and your friendship, purified through your affection and your love, given yearning for the meeting with you, made pleased with your decree, granted gazing upon your face, shown the favor of your good pleasure. O Allah, place us among those whose habit is rejoicing in you and yearning for you, whose time is spent in sighing and moaning, their foreheads are bowed down before your mightiness, their eyes are wakeful in your service, their tears flowing in dread of you, their hearts fixed upon your love, and their cores shaken with awe of you. So these verses of prayer are overflowing with concepts of love, intimacy, and yearning. Of course, we do not intend to comment on these prayers, because I assume it seems impossible to add to these verses any beauty apart from what they already contain. But the first thing that draws our attention in these verses of love is the call with which the infallible Imam alayhi salam is calling out his Lord. He goes, O utmost limit of the hopes of the lovers. So Imam alayhi salam has three requests in this prayer, the great three which a servant asks from his Lord. Firstly, he asks from Allah to choose him for himself and purify his heart for his love and make empty his look for his noble face and make him desirous of what is with him and free his breast for his love, inspire him with his remembrance, cut off him all of that which cut him off from him and turn from him all that which turn him away from him. And such a start is essential for the move that Imam alayhi salam is asking from the Almighty Allah, whose goal he defines as gazing upon the face of Allah.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah that we hear.
it's not a dream, this is so true. And we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of Dua.
It is not possible for a person without such a start to move through this difficult and tedious path to the climax of meeting with Allah and gazing upon His honorable face, which is indeed the source of ease for every prophet and friend of Allah. If looking at the face of Allah is a provision and rizq which Almighty Allah provides for whomsoever He wishes and chooses from among His servants, then the servant must ask Allah to provide him such a provision, together with its keys, of course. Because when Almighty Allah provides any of His servants with a provision, He gives him through its doors and keys, and facilitates for him its causes and its means. And on the contrary, those who pray to Allah to grant them a provision from other than its doors and without its proper means and causes, are in fact beseeching Him against His norms and sunan, against those laws which He has ordained for His servants. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.